Blog Talk Radio.
I'm a truth terrorist. I'm a knowledge gangster. I'm a black history hitman. I'm a lie killer, urban gorilla. I gotta be a roughneck.
Free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for free the Black Panthers. If up the black police, that 13th Amendment. Trying to make a slave of me. You can lock my body, can't trap my mind, not forever be free.
Okay,
free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for free the Black Panthers. And fuck the black police. Feds infiltrated our movements for black leadership roles. But we still here, finna build here. Up coins held pro.
Show.
They got me started, lion hearted. I'm the new Mufasa. And I'm all about Umoja, first in Guzu Saba. Let's bring back the black families, we need our father. Single mama, son and daughter, that's root of the problem. Wise up, we wise up, unity is so powerful. Black banks, black schools, black owned, black power moves. You telling lies, if you think this shit's gonna be televised. Black power, be scared guys, they be standing there like they paralyzed, huh? We say fuck the system, cause we above the system. We keep ARs and pistols, shotguns that's worth a crystal. But that's for self-defense, make sure we have no issues. Be sure to leave it at the door if you have it with you. This for them freedom fighters, that lost their freedom. Until they freedom, we screaming carpe diem. This for the general, King Khalid Muhammad. We gon' make your day a holiday, I fuck me promise.
Free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for free the Black Panthers. And fuck the black police. That 13th Amendment, tryna make a slave of me. You can lock my body, can't trap my mind, not forever be free.
Okay,
free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for free the Black Panthers. And fuck the black police. Feds infiltrated our movement for black leadership roles. But we still here, finna build here. Up coins hell pro.
RBG. My sisters, my brothers, the council, the elders, cause that's really all I need. We suited, we booted, don't do it, you stupid, we head to the armory. Black woman and goddess, regardless, my heart just don't fuck with misogyny. Bullshit that don't tolerate it, melanated, so you gotta hate it. Barack upped up another conversation, Trump finna get inaugurated, damn. Unify or die, NBPP.org.
First and foremost, the new Black Panther Party, no other Black Panther Party, we are not violent. We are for self-defense and self-determination. The most violent group in this country are the police. What is taking place by the police departments to black people across this country is ethnic cleansing and genocide. It has escalated since the day that Barack Obama was inaugurated in 2008. We have a people who are only 13% of the population, yet we make up 80% of the prisons. We have 50% unemployment rate in the black community, and it's actually even more than that because they're not counting our people that are in the prison. The 13th Amendment says you cannot be made a slave or indentured servant unless you commit a crime. The 14th Amendment forced our people to be subjects of this government. We never had any say in that. We need our own nation. We need our own nation. Black power, black power, black power, brothers and sisters. Welcome to the new Black Panther Party for Self-Defense Nightly Broadcast. Tonight, Monday night, March 28, 2022, we're going to be listening to the teachings of the great elder, the great ancestor, the author of the Blueprint for Black Power, the Honorable Dr. Amos Wilson.
He was talking about the fact that we describe these issues a great deal. We talk about them and we analyze them, and we rarely get a chance to talk about solutions. Well, we've been working on solutions. We're going to talk about power not from the point of view of being victimized by it, but by developing it and using it against our enemies. At the last lecture I gave at the Slave Theater, where we were talking about global white supremacy, I initiated this theme on power by saying that we can explain the reasons Europeans victimize us in as many ways as we would like. We could talk about them as being ice people, as against the sun people, and that explanation is valid. I have no problems with it. We can talk about them in terms of their protecting their more recessive genes against our more dominant genes. We can even get into a little psychoanalysis and deal with the myth of length of penises and penis envy, all the other things, and black balls and white balls and brown balls and black holes and white balls rolling into black holes and things of this nature. And all that's fine. That's a lot of fun. But no matter how you explain why or how the European got to the point of victimizing us, I think the essential issue is that the European victimizes us because he can, because he has the power to do so. And we are victimized because we haven't developed the power to prevent his doing so. So in a sense, no matter how we explain why he does what he does, at the end point, he does what he does because he can. And consequently then, I infer from this that we can end his victimization of us when we end his power to do so. And consequently, I want to bring into the domain of discussion in this community the subject matter of power. I want us, in addition to studying black history and culture, to study power, its accumulation, its use, and application. We should talk about it every day and everywhere. We should read about it, and we should develop the means of using it. We should come to understand the nature of how white power is organized. In the end, power does not flow from the genes of white folk. Does that not flow from their ice age? It flows from the nature of their organization and the way they have chosen to relate one to the others. And it flows from their intentionality as a people and their appropriate organization of themselves to realize their intentionality, one of which is, of course, the domination of African people. And that means then that we as African people must study the rules of organization. We must study the means of relating one to each other in such a way that we multiply our power. And we must study our enemy's organization such that we can probe that organization and destroy the power of the enemy. And we can do it. We have a tremendous amount of power in our hands. Right here in America, we are not a weak people by any stretch of the imagination. The only weakness is in our minds and in our imaginations. That's the only place. We are not a dependent people in the material sense, only in the psychological sense. The only thing, ladies and gentlemen, we must get over is our cowardice. That's the only thing. That's the only thing. And we can change this. I will speak briefly then to the issue this evening relating to the message that Dr. Bragan brought you last week around this conference titled Genetic Factors in Crime, Findings, Uses, and implications which was to occur at the University of Maryland. I've warned you many times, and I've told you many times, I don't know whether it gets through to you or not, but we as black people must get over this thing of looking at schools and universities as advanced vocational training institutions. How many people recall that I've repeated this time and time again? That the function of education is not jobs. That is not the primary function. Children and people are educated. The primary function for education is to advance the interests of a people and to protect their interests, to secure their survival. That the educational structures and institutions of this country are as much a part of its defense, of its armed forces, as are its soldiers. The bombs, the weaponry that this nation uses against other nations and intimidates other nations with, develop out of the universities. The germ warfare, the chemical warfare, political, because some great professor is the head of this particular department, or they have illustrious names in the department, chances are you will never see them teach you in a class. The graduate students on some kind of assistantship will more likely be your teacher. Where are the brains and where are the professors? They're doing research, and often they're doing research on government grants for the government, for the corporations, for the other institutions in the society, and they are part of then the total system of domination of this country. Afrocentric education above all, and even beyond the teaching of African history and African culture, is preparing our children to defend the very lives of African people. Is a military preparation and a preparation for war. It is the means by which we will maintain our biological survival as a people. For if you do not survive, what does it matter if you teach reading to 100% of our children, or they learn math well, or they learn computer science, or all the other things you think are important, when your very lives are in the balance, and it is very likely that they will be snuffed out in the next 10 to 20 years. And yet we still continue to look at schools and colleges and universities as vocational institutions. And here we have then at the University of Maryland, long connected with the U.S. Army, by the way, hosting a conference on so-called genetic factors in crime. Reagan charged that this meeting, which was canceled, was part of a broader program, a violence initiative, a federal government research agenda, so that this program was only a part of a larger agenda. And it was designed to move toward finding a genetic marker that would supposedly identify children at high risk of becoming criminals and to develop plans to deter them through medication. And this is interesting due to the fact that there's little or no real information that links directly in any kind of strong way or even in a mild way a relationship between genes and criminality. There's been no DNA segment that has been discovered that codes for crime. When you think about it, the idea is ludicrous anyway. What is crime? What is violence? What is violence? In other words, I'm asking this question because you have to do a linguistic analysis. They are all forms of what? Violence. There are many different types of what? Crime. Different types of aggression. Not all violence is necessarily bad. There's what we in psychology may call hostile aggression. But there is aggression or violence that may be used in terms of what? Self-defense. Violence may be used to protect your children from attack. Violence may be used to protect the lives of other people. So now, if we're going to get a gene for violence, or a type of violence, or in removing the gene for violence, if we were to find it, which is an unlikely situation, are we also removing a people's capacity to defend themselves and to use violence in their own interest? What I'm saying is then, be very careful when people use words like violence, aggression, crime, and so forth, and ask yourself, what kind of crime? You know, do we have a gene for every type of crime you can name? So that even when we change definitions of crime, a new gene comes into being that we're going to find related to that particular crime. And when we decide that certain other behavior is no longer a crime, will the gene which was coded for that crime disappear? Ludicrous. Ludicrous. I talk in Black on Black Violence about the structuration of crime. That crime follows the type of violence that we talk about, or crime, even its nature, follows the class structure and follows the skills levels of criminals. You see? Why is there so much so-called violent crime in certain segments of the society? Because when you look at the skills levels of the people committing them, if they were to commit a crime, that's about the only crime they could commit. If they were accountants, they would commit the crime of embezzlement and steal hundreds of thousands or millions because they have a particular ability or skill. And you'd be a fool if you were an accountant or in an S&L where you can steal millions of dollars and then make the public pay billions back and then hang out on the street and knock somebody out in the head. So here we have this crimogenic society that robs our people of skills and other means, so that if they decide to participate in a crime, then the probability is that it will be violent by the very nature of the way the society has set them up in the beginning. In other words, the society even determines the type of crime you are most likely to commit itself. Okay? And then it tells you, you're violent. Teach me to be an accountant. I won't hit any more people in the head. I'll just rob them by books. Okay? And then they want to talk about white collar crime and, you know, in the other kind of collar crime. Come on, wake up. This has nothing to do with genes. It has to do with the nature. I've also told you about reversal, right? I mentioned the fact that in order for us as a people to be in the situation that we're in, we literally have to be turned backwards. We have to think backwards, behave backwardly, deal with the world backwardly. It's necessary. It's the only way the system can maintain itself. Sometimes I say the best way to win an argument is to concede to your opponent. Okay, there is a genetic marker for crime. Let's now look at the criminal records of African peoples and European peoples. The record is clear. If there is a genetic marker for crime, when we look at the fact that the European has committed a crime against every people on every continent, destroyed millions of people, then that argues for his genetic criminality. And that argues then for us to medicate him and control him. You know, the other thing I'm surprised at is we keep being surprised. We keep thinking that this is some new initiative. I mean, the violence initiative began with our enslavement and continues today. We already have bought the violence initiative, ladies and gentlemen. It is already operating. We bought it when we bought learning disabilities, when we bought the concept of hyperactivity, when we bought the concept of impulsivity, when we bought the concept of special education. You're already in it. Connected to these so-called symptoms of learning disability are the very same symptoms they're going to try to connect to the so-called genetic markers. And our children are already being drugged. The violence initiative has already occurred because our youth are already going to jail in record numbers. So why are we talking about these people are initiating something to bring and put our youth in jail? They're already in jail. Those that are not already in jail are in juvenile detention, are under the aegis of the VCWs. You heard it tonight. In the special education program, already being drugged, already being therapized, already having their minds distorted in various ways. And the worst violence initiative program is the public educational system itself. So this so-called initiative that you're talking about tonight is a mopping up operation. That's all it is. If you're telling me in Washington, D.C. and other places, black youth and black people, 75% are in some form of contact with the criminal justice system already. Some 60% in any given day in Baltimore and other areas are already in contact with the criminal justice system. Well, then what will this new initiative do? Just make it what? 100%. We should have already been what? Upset. Why are we kicking and screaming now? We should have been screaming already. This initiative is an old trick in psychiatry and psychology. It's a trick that we call the medicalization of social problems. That is to define a social and political problem as a medical problem, and to put psychiatrists who are doctors, physicians with MDs in control of the definition of these problems, even though they are an arm of the state, as are social workers, as are psychologists, as are all of the other helping professionals, but members of the state and arms of the state. But we are so willing to submit to their authority such that when they define social and political behavior and behavior which has social and political causes in medical terms, even the oppressed and the victimized consent to their mistreatment. Louis Sullivan is a part of this, but in a sense we are all a part of it, because we buy the medicalization of issues. And they know, since we are willing to do anything the doctor says, tells us to do, why are you taking that poison? The doctor said, take it every 2 hours. The doctor says. So now if the doctor says that your children have a marker, a genetic marker, then let's go with it. And we don't have time in the evening, one of these days we'll talk about psychiatric power and the role of psychiatrists in the system. Oh, the history of psychiatrists are horrendous. You won't believe it. You won't believe the tortures that have been created in the name of psychiatry that are even being perpetrated today. You won't believe the robbing of civil liberties, the robbing of freedom and all other kinds of things, the complete destruction and taking away of people's constitutional rights in the name of psychiatry. When you medicalize a problem and define it in medical terms, the patient loses all rights. And therefore, you can resolve a lot of issues that, if they were defined politically or socially, would then become constitutional and legal issues. But as soon as they are put under the aegis of medicine, then you reduce to a very great extent the legal and constitutional implications. So what we have going here then is an attempt to move social and political problems into the area of psychiatry so that we, even as African people, can consent to social control and the killing of our people. One quick thing, and I know we're short here. Don't get caught up in this brain and biological basis of behavior. Okay? Don't be deceived because someone can say that they have found a biological correlate with behavior. That means it is genetic in nature, or that means it's congenital, or that means that the society has no responsibility for the behavior that the person is committing. Don't buy that baloney. People run that a lot. You know, as soon as we can locate some kind of brain deficiency and correlate it, then we're ready to say, oh, society is not responsible for it. Are you kidding? Learning and experience physically transforms the brain. Traumatic experiences and even positive experiences changes the biochemical nature of the brain, as well as the neuronal functional organization of the brain, and influences the number of dendrites and synapses and other things that cells use to communicate one with the other. Now, you must understand here then, and I could talk a great deal here about the experiments here that have shown very clearly that if you put certain animals through certain experiences, their brains actually can increase in weight. Let me give you a quick run of things that happens when some rats were placed in various environments. One group was placed in a so-called enriched environment. These rats being selected from the same genetic background, having the same genetic background and the same genetic inheritance. But they were put in under different environments. After they were put through, after they lived in these environments for a while, they were sacrificed and their brains looked at, weighed, measured, and analyzed. Now, those rats that were put in an enriched environment, let's look at some of the things that were found. They had an increased thickness of the cerebral cortex, or the gray matter. In other words, the thinking matter of their brain increased in thickness and weight. A 15% increase in the actual size of the neurons in the cortex. Increases in protein in the brain paralleling the increases in cortical weight are indicating that the growth effect was on tissue and not just on the fluid content of the brain. An increase in the amount of dendritic branching, dendrites are the hairy branching fibers which project in large numbers from the body of each neuron and which receive input from other neurons and conduct them to the cell bodies of other neurons. There was an increase in the branching of these neurons, and a greater amount of potential information was available to each neuron. An increased number of dendritic spikes per unit length of dendrite. Increases in the number of synapses and the sizes of the contacts between the synapses. An increase in the ratio between the weight of the cortex and the weight of the rest of the brain. A 15% increase in the number of glial cells, and on we go. What are we saying here then? That experience changes the brain. changes the nature and the functionality of the brain. So simply because you may find a brain correlate does not take society off the hook. It means then that if society controls the experience of a people, controls their experiences, it is manipulating their brain and controlling its size. And so they want to run a game on you with this biological substrate number. A quick reference here to some tentative research that was noted in the New York Times Wednesday, September 16th. And you should read this piece, and the research is tentative, but read the scientific journals. But there's something interesting here. The headline reads, "Behavior therapy can change how the brain functions," researchers say. "Like drug therapy, behavior modification therapy produces metabolic," what do we mean there? "Chemical enzymatic changes in the brain and functional changes," that is how different parts and areas of the brain relate one to the other in controlling a behavior and initiating a behavior. Know what I'm saying? Like drug therapy, behavior modification. This is a non-drug therapy, right? This is a therapy based on social relationships between the therapist and the client. Okay, and that's what we are comparing here. And what does it say here then? Both of these produces metabolic and functional changes in the brains of people with obsessive compulsive disorder. It is the first time that behavior therapy, remember we're talking about a basic social thing here, even though there's some other adjuncts to it, a method that changes the way people think, and I'm emphasizing think, about uncomfortable thoughts or feelings, the way they deal with uncomfortable thoughts and feelings, this therapy particularly relating to obsessive compulsive behavior where people are exhibiting certain attitudes toward compelling thoughts and behaviors. So this therapy, which seeks to change the way they think about these compulsive feelings and think about these thoughts and these urgings that keep telling them to do things, has been shown to physically alter brain function in a mental disorder. And we could go on, the piece was longer. I brought this up to get those who might think that we only talk about rats. What are we saying here then? That the very nature of human relations itself can change the functional nature of the brain. The idea being then that even when they come to you and tell you that there's some kind of correlation between a brain functionality and a particular behavior, don't fall for the okey-doke that necessarily means that the society is not responsible for producing that behavior. Society shapes the brain as it shapes other things as well. I'll move on quickly here. The theme of black-on-black violence, the book, is that the alleged criminality of black males will be used to justify the repression of the African-American community and quite possibly its genocidal annihilation. In other words, the running theme of the book, Black on Black Violence, is this, that the alleged criminality of African males will be used as a major rationale so that when this society decides that it will annihilate this community, the other members and nations and people in the world will buy it because they have been convinced that we are innately criminal. And what I'm trying to get across in there then is how this propaganda is developed. This is why, despite what you say from a logical point of view, despite the fact you may say this is not the majority of our youth who are in jail, the vast majority of you are not engaged in violent behavior. The majority of people on welfare are not black people. The majority of people in prisons are not black folk. You know, you can lay one fact after another, and yet what happens? The people still insist in seeing it as a black problem, don't they? When you lay evidence and facts before a people, even evidence and facts that they themselves have collected, and they still insist in seeing you in a particular way, then you must recognize that they are seeing you in that way because it is important to their own psychological state of being and because it serves their own interests. Yes. And you must ask the question then, why are they obsessed about projecting this kind of image? And you will see then that it is there to rationalize their behavior against you. They're not, and therefore, as I will say a little later on, this idea of arguing with these people point for point is not what the game is about. It's not what it's about. Let me quickly move on. I want to lay a context, because often we discuss these issues out of context. And I've told you before, as I've told you in Black on Black Violence, that European sociology, psychology, and so forth decontextualizes issues, meaning that it discusses violence or crime as if they do not exist within a social context, as if they do not have a history, as if they do not serve a function in the society. So you're made to look directly at the behavior and the behavior only, and to judge it and treat it without looking at the context in which it occurs and look at how the context itself may create the behavior. And even behavior therapy plays this game, by the way. Okay? You must start at the context first before you discuss these problems. What is the context? The context is this, that we are a dominated people. We are dominated by European people. Am I making myself clear?
Yes.
This is where we start. This is where you start. We are under the control of another people. We are vulnerable to that other people who are holding our lives and the quality of our lives in their hands. That's the fact you must start with. The second fact is, domination is a social problem. Am I clear here? Domination itself is a problem. It is a social problem, particularly for the dominated, isn't it? Even if it's for the dominator, it's still a social problem. Keep this in mind. Domination, therefore, generates the very existence of domination means that a social problem has been what? Generated. Huh? You can't have domination without having a what? Social problem. So domination generates a social problem, and as long as it exists, it maintains that social problem. As long as you're under the domination of Europeans, you will have social problems. There are some idiots among us who think that they can leave the European in control of African people and get justice and peace. It is not possible. Domination is built on injustice. And you cannot then leave the European in power over black people and then expect to be to receive justice. It's illogical. It's not possible. Domination benefits the dominator. We are dominated because it what? Benefits those who dominate us. Therefore, the dominator benefits from the social what? Problems. In other words, the problems of black people benefit white folk. And they are created for their benefit, and they are maintained for their benefit. And therefore, those who dominate us have an investment, monetarily and every other way, in perpetuating the symptoms of maladjustment in us as a people, and they engage in interactions that reinforce those problems. That's why no matter what kind of program they lay out for you, it does not resolve the social problems that they claim they're designed to resolve. And I'll be through in a, just for a second or two here. The problems of the dominated provide evidence which justifies their domination and supports their own domination. Ladies and gentlemen, one of the major outcomes of power and one of the major benefits of being powerful is that you can generate the evidence to justify your power and to justify your domination. Why, when I go to prison, I see that 56% of you are in this prison. Therefore, we are justified in controlling you. But then we forget how what? They created the problem so that 56% could be in there. Now then, as the gentleman who wrote Blaming the Victim put forth, and I will say, first of all, this problem is created. Our problems are needed. This is what I'm arguing in Black on Black Violence, that this society needs the criminality of black males. It needs the fantasy that black males are criminals. It is necessary to the very structure and being of this society. It is very necessary to the self-definition of Europeans. It is very necessary to maintaining their domination and advancing their domination. Therefore, they must create these problems, or they must even imagine that these problems exist where they truly do not exist. Therefore, they create the problem, and then, as Ryan argues, first, they identify the social problem. Second, they study those affected by the problem and discover in what ways they are different from the rest of us, this great underclass. How are they different from the rest of us? And you know now, arguing black on black, that the so-called criminals in the jails are not any different from any of the rest of us. You are not going to find a criminal personality. You know, and yet that's been the golden grail of psychology. You know, how can we distinguish these people from the rest of us? We're all in this game together. Third, they define the differences as the causes of the social problem. In other words, we create the problem. Then we go in and look at the people who have the problem and see how they're different from those who don't. And then we say, oh, their differences is the reason why they have the problem. You see, so they're going to create these brain dysfunctions, then go in and find the brain dysfunction, and then say the brain dysfunction is the cause of the problem. Now let's medicate. So they define, they use the differences, and finally they assign a government bureaucrat to invent a humanitarian action program to correct the differences. I asked my class the other night, what if we could find a 100% sure shot rehabilitation program? A program that would rehabilitate 100% of the clients. Would that solve your problem? No, because what would happen? The others would keep what? Rolling in. So rehabilitating the ones who have the problem does not solve what? The original what? Cause of the problem. And again, we have people who enter into the wrong point of the equation. Let me get here then and say, these controversies, such as the one we are dealing with now, they speak to the need for domination to justify and maintain itself. Howard Zinn stated, the establishment, whatever rewards it gives us, will also, if necessary, to maintain its control, kill us. Hear that, black bourgeoisie. A part of your being promoted in American society is to maintain control of the black community. The day that your death is necessary also to maintain control and to maintain white power, they will kill you as well. And I want you to keep this in mind then. I don't want you to fall into the trap of discussing this particular issue. We fall into a trap by concentrating on the scientific and methodological details. You know, well, there's no genes. When you find it, forget all that nonsense. And get caught up in personalities. Well, Goodwin is an evil guy. You know, Louis Sullivan is a... Screw all of that. It's the same kind of thing you have with Columbus. If Columbus had not discovered America, some other European would have. Even if you could step back into history and kill Columbus, you're still in the same shape you are right now. Because what is the essential problem here? Columbus didn't build the ships. Columbus didn't build the technology. It was European technology, political and economic organization that made it possible for Columbus to come over here. And it was European technology, organization, intentionality that made it possible for them to overrun the Indian nations. What you have here then were two different cultures and two different technologies and two different ways of thinking facing each other, and one ran over the other. Not Columbus. I want you to get out of the personality issue and deal with the deep issue. You are facing a society and a culture. You are facing an organization that will put man after man after man in front of you, but it will still run its same program. You must learn to cripple the organization, not the person. This is an old argument. It's the same kind of old game that went on with the genetic basis of intelligence. This is the same old game refried. What do we have here? Let's look at the deeper issue. And the deeper issue involves the need to justify domination, social control, and to obscure the very real way deficiencies are created by power relations. Quick question here. Why are whites obsessively concerned with the intelligence of black folks? This is the thing you must ask first before you get into whether it's environment or genes. Ask the major question. Why are you interested? What's the point? Huh? Why is it so what? Important for you to know. What are you going to do with the knowledge? This is the issue. What would be the result if it was definitely and irrefutably established that blacks are innately less intelligent than whites? Let's ask that question. Let's ask another one. Are we found irrefutably that we were more intelligent than whites? What would be the results? Are just as intelligent as whites, or that environment is really significantly influential in determining intelligence? What would be the result if we discovered either one of these things? What would be the result if we proved that blacks were genetically more docile than white folk? The end result would what? Be the same. Would be the same. Nothing is going to change. Why? The findings, whatever their nature, will be used to justify and rationalize the social control of black people by white people. In other words, ladies and gentlemen, if they proved that we were innately less intelligent than they would justify domination, wouldn't it? We are more intelligent, therefore we have a right to rule over you. But then if you prove to them in your great work that you are more intelligent than they are, well, these people are more intelligent than we are. We should suppress them while we can, because if we let them loose, they will take over. So the repression would still take place, and it would still be argued. Well, they are as intelligent as we are, and that means one day they may compete with us, so let's still what? Repress them. Oh, you mean the environment is truly significant in intelligence. So what would the result be then? Let us control what? The environment to control their intelligence. In other words, ladies and gentlemen, the final come down of it all, no matter how you refute these people, no matter how much detail you roll out one way or the other, they will always be used to do what? Justify repression and oppression. That is the issue, not making fine, pointy arguments as to whether IQ tests are culturally based or genetically based or this so-called initiative here. It's pointless. What we have going here is an attempt by people who are dominating us to create new rules and means by which they justify their domination and repression. That's all that's going on here. Screw whatever excuse they rolled up in time. The only thing that has changed by any so-called new initiative, such as the one we're talking about today, is the logic of justification for continuing domination and the methodology of domination. That's the only thing that's changed. Nothing has changed by this new initiative. All this said, well, their violence is a medical problem, and therefore, now the methodology for that is to do what? Cut their brains out and medicate them and so forth. But the end result is still what? Domination and control. Thus, the central issue revolves around power and domination and maintaining the relative powerlessness of black people and finding rationales for doing so. For a very sizable percentage of black problems flow from the nature of black and white power relations. These problems that we are dealing with flow from our powerlessness, from the power differential between blacks and white folks. They reflect the differences in power between us as people. Nothing else. No brain issues here. The issue then for the black community is this: how to break white power and the will of whites and any other ethnic group to dominate and exploit African people. And I'm telling you, any other ethnic group, because whites are not the only ones who are moving in place to dominate African people. And the issue then is this, and you must keep this in mind. This must be our agenda. This is our agenda, to break the power of people to control our lives. This is the agenda. An agenda set by us, not by others. Our program for change and empowerment, for enhancing the education of our children, for maximizing our quality of life, should continue regardless of academic and social debates regarding the social or genetic bases of criminality, intelligence, and so forth. What am I saying? We must keep focused on changing the nature of power in this world. Regardless of the debates about what is going on. If you get caught up in the details, you're going to lose the focus. One other thing, and I'm through. We got some people out here looking for conspiracies. I want to note this because I see a lot of this going on, and there are people on the circus getting over on the conspiracy number. And there are others, you know. Let me just warn you about one thing, black people. You must think in terms of a nation. You must think of yourself as a nation. It's very important that you think of yourself as a nation. Many of the issues that you see confronting you can become very clear if you think of yourself as a nation surrounded by other nations. I tell people, I haven't written a second book on the cause of violence, the economic cause of violence, but there is an economic cause. I talked about the psychodynamics in black on black, but there's another part of the story, which is the economics. Quickly, it's like this, ladies and gentlemen. If you saw black people in the United States as a nation, you would recognize that to a very great extent, the social disorganization that we complain about, the breakdown of families and institutions, the criminality of our children and so forth, is the result of the fact that as a nation, black people are suffering from a negative trade imbalance, from a trade imbalance. In other words, black people have an overwhelming national debt. What do we mean by that? It means that more of your money, earnings, income are flowing out than what? Are flowing in. You jump for equal opportunity and you educated your most talented people, and you sent them away from you and sent them to work for other people. And the monies they earn, you told them to live among those other people so they contribute their brains and skills to your enemies and spend their monies among your enemies and enhance their power. And now they become neoconservatives and join the attack on the African community. You understand what I'm saying? Anytime a nation buys more than it sells, anytime that a nation ships its wealth out in great bundles, anytime a nation lets other alien groups, Arabs, Koreans, and others, and whites, come into its midst and take its money out, and then let the drug dealers scrape up the rest and take that money out, their institutions are going to collapse on their heads. Your families are breaking up because they do not have the economic floor that they need to keep them there. Your children are going wild because you don't have the money to give them the appropriate education and recreation and other kind of things you need. You cannot build the institutions that you need to maintain the viability of your society because you're giving it to everyone else. And you're shipping it out. And therefore you suffer from it. Now, with this view in mind, what does this mean? You can solve this problem to a very great extent if you think of yourself as a nation, remove the aliens from your midst, and thrust out into the world and earn wealth and money and bring it back to your nation and watch its prosperity increase and watch the people become more civil with one another, build the kind of institutions to create the kind of schools you want. But until you do that, it's not going to happen. This is the program. Conspiracy, then. There are people out here looking for the mad scientist who made the AIDS gene. And now they're looking at Goodwin. Is he? Oh, he's the madman that's getting ready to run the nuts sort of thing. And there are others who are in the government huddling around. Screw all that. Stop wasting your time hunting for the smoking gun. When you are a nation, you recognize one thing. When you discover the conspiracy, it's too late. Yeah, it's too late. When you discover it, it's too late. If you are a nation, you know what you act on as a nation? You act on capability of your enemy. They can be your friends, as a matter of fact. They can have good relationships with you. But the moment they develop the capacity to destroy you, you don't worry about whether they hate you or love you or they're conspiring against you. You recognize that they have the capacity to destroy you should they want to. You don't search for the conspirators. You search for a way to defend yourself against one should it occur. It's the fact that whites have the capacity to use AIDS that should move us to build a defense. That they have the capacity to destroy African nations that should move us to build a military. That they have the capacity to destroy our people in economic warfare. Not whether they are thinking of doing so or whether there's some person who's doing so. Screw that. Don't put the energy in what? Building a defense and an offense on the fact that they are capable of doing so. All right? It's necessary. So, ladies and gentlemen, our eyes, we should do what? Keep the agenda on changing the power relationship, empowering ourselves so that we can defend ourselves regardless of the type of conspiracies any groups have against us. So what does it mean, ladies and gentlemen? Keeping our eyes on the prize. And that prize is power. Power to the people. Thank you very much.
WLIB, good afternoon. You're inside of the GBE. Thank you for joining us.
Peace and love, my brother.
Thank you. I want you to make sure you turn your radio all the way down. And for the other callers, please do that. It'll save us time. Go right ahead.
I'm listening. This is very, very interesting. And what I'm interested to know is if there was a possibility. See, I listen to you, Gary, and I admire you to the utmost, and so do your audience. And we talk about leadership in the black community, and you, I see you as a model, all right? And brothers like your guests and other brothers like Automatics and just the series of brothers who have been fighting in the revolution, if all of us as a nation, the black people right now, would pool in our monies and like people like you, Gary, and the people that I have mentioned who can oversee, we'll pool in all of our hundreds of millions of dollars, and you all being the monitors, the leaders of that, and us monitoring because we trust you. I mean, we have to look at it now realistically. We understand our predicament and our position, what we got to do about it now. So, I mean, Gary, let's make a call out. I'm calling out to the community now as I'm sitting here and I'm listening. We should put together a board of electors of the brothers that are mentioned and so forth and so on. Course, these are the brothers that we trust and we believe in.
Let me just step in for a moment because we're moving a little bit towards news headlines, but I hear the caller coming with, I think, the economic energy and the thrust of that whole reality, which has come up on this program so much, and I know that you have some perspectives about that, Professor Wilson. So what we'll do is this. To the caller, I want you to update yourself with the local, national, international news headlines for just a moment, and Professor Wilson, when we come back, we'll pick up on the economic dimensions of your question, and certainly what I think is a very honest and sincere call for the idea of us coming together and doing something, and maybe we'll talk about some of the reasons why that hasn't happened and some of the things that have to happen for it to happen when we come back right after this. At 1190 WLIB, World Leadership in Broadcasting. Amos Wilson, our topic is the psychology of self-hatred among global African people. And we had a caller just a moment ago who raised the economic dimension and certainly, I guess, the economic possibility. I constantly have had conversations about the potential that we have in terms of being an economic force. And it, there's no point in repeating the numbers of us who are in churches, right, community organizations, and how in just one weekend, you know, we could raise, you know, obviously enough money to create our own banking system.
Certainly.
In one weekend. Professor Wilson, that caller was reaching out.
That's in part the effect of the self-hatred, which leads to a squandering of economic resources. The inability of the black community to use this tremendous economic wealth for its own interests is indicative of the issue that we're talking about here today.
Mm-hmm.
I hope we get around to talking about, when I talk about the effects of dealing with self-hatred, one of the effects, of course, is the misspending of money.
How so, though? How does that work?
Because money is misspent, again, to relieve pain, you see, to compensate for inferiorities. And because the individual has been reversed, which we'll have to explain at some later point, you will see a situation where almost inevitably the spending for getting over an inferiority complex involves spending the money with the person who gave it to you in the first place.
Okay. Wait a minute. There's something you have, yeah, a thing about anger and resentment binding the oppressor to the oppressor.
Yes, and this is a part of the aspect of it, you see. You want to buy the approval, you want to buy, you mentioned even in the Garvey statement, you want to buy the products that restructure the image. And because you see, the essence of controlling people is to provoke a desire in them. And then, of course, have control of the satisfaction of that desire. You see?
Mm.
And that's at the foundation of the capitalist system and of the economic system, you see. And you can provoke that desire in them either through anger, through hatred, through direct tantalizing of the individual. See, the key to being in the ruling class is to create desire first,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
and to have control over the resources for the satisfaction of the desire.
So provoke a desire, then service the need.
Then service the need.
Yeah.
But you also lay the conditions down for getting the need serviced. And that way you create the behavior in the process. and you create the personality in the process. So
and those who can't get into that don't fit.
No, not at all. So so the idea is, if you feel, so if you're cursed, often we say your behavior then will involve trying to get the person to remove the curse, which sends you back to the individual asking their acceptance. And of course, often they will make a few demands on you, which you have to fulfill before you can gain that acceptance back again. If you feel as if, and see what happens when we were robbed, and we are robbed as people, we see who have it, but who has what has been robbed from us. But we also forced to buy back because we can't buy it from ourselves. We don't have it. You see, and so when we try to compensate for a loss of status by dressing well, we got to go to Bloomies or somewhere, you know. When we try to compensate for a loss of a status by buying a house, we go to the white community, you see. Or by eating at, and we want to show those people that we're as good as they are, so forth. You see, all of this effort to compensate and prove something and to be accepted and all of this kind of be, or to escape, is going to send you directly back to the people who created the situation in the first place.
Amazing.
You see, so it works very beautifully. That caller had an implication there that was, that again, people don't deal with, except I've seen Chancellor William deal with it in this book, and I try to get people to understand, read the whole of the Chancellor William book, because often they read it as history, you see.
Let's give book titles here, too.
Yeah, The Destruction of Black Civilization.
Yes.
And, of course, at the back part of that book, he's dealing with, of course, Reconstruction, and he's dealing with political, social, and economic plans. Of course, when you study the movement of Marcus Garvey, as well as the movement of Elijah Muhammad and others, you see it implied there. And that implication is nation building. The creation of a national network, economic, social, political network by black people, and a national economic program of development, political, social program by black people. Now, I don't want this to be interpreted as advocating the overthrow of the United States government, okay? I'm talking about the kind of informal organization that you often find in other ethnic groups that have, you know, so-and-so congresses and the congress of leaders from various regions and situations of this kind that come together and have a policy, political, social, economic policy, which is coordinated nationwide and then into worldwide as well. We have not done that. We have the foundation for it. We have a whole network of black churches. You also saw the network being laid in Elijah Muhammad's system as well. We're going to have to look at that, see how we can informally set up this kind of network, because once we do this, we can lay the basis for real productive economics. And I will talk later on about how productive economics in the United States is tied to the productive economics of African people the world over, and the economic activity of black people in this country is crucial to economic development of African people the world over.
Professor Amos Wilson at WLIB, good afternoon. You're in The Experience. Go right ahead, please, with your question or comment.
Good afternoon.
Okay, make sure you turn your radio all the way down. It's going to save us a lot of time. Everybody, if you're listening, I'm going to say this one time. Please make sure that you are near your radio and make sure that it's right there at your fingertips to turn it right away at a lower volume so that we can save as much time as possible. We thank you. Go right ahead, please.
Yes. Mr. Bird, thank you so much for having Professor Amos Wilson on. And your WLIB is doing a fantastic job in opening up the consciousness of African Americans. I simply wanted to state that my father gave us a Bible, and that was a philosophy and opinion of Marcus Garvey. We did not have a white Christ in our home. He painted it black, and it had a profound effect on our lives. Now, the younger people in the family have also had this kind of awakening, and as Professor Amos pointed out, there is a punishment. I have been dealt the punishment throughout, and I'm wondering, beyond the step of the Skinner experiment, how does one deal with coping in the system.
Mm-hmm.
When you are punished, even though you might excel, how is one able to escape the punishment that is dealt to you?
How do you escape the black ache? Here we go.
Often, frankly, there is not an escape, per se.
Mm-hmm.
One thing we have to recognize, and I've recognized personally, is that when you accept certain positions, given the nature of the way things are, you're going to have to accept certain consequences. Not accept them in that you think you should have them,
mm-hmm.
but
mm-hmm.
you know that they are going to occur. And I've often told many people, if you really are going to go deeply into the philosophies that we're talking about here of nationalism and so forth, you have to realize that you are going to suffer some consequences. You're not going to be socially mobile all of the time, and you're going to lose some things. But with a deep understanding, it means often then giving up some of those desires that have been artificially created in the first place, so that the loss of them or the non-attainment of them does not represent a painful loss for you as an individual and a person. A deep understanding, too, of the consequences and of oneself and the nature of one's enemies, and a deep spiritual, and I'm not talking about the spookism religion, okay, of will allow one then to suffer these privations with a certain peace of mind. You see, a certain sensitiveness that permits one to bear these kinds of pains.
Is that being done, though, with a particular goal or objective in mind?
Well, yes,
concept?
Because you realize you're going to pay a price for it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's hardly a way you're going to escape it.
You can't.
No, yeah. Very unlikely. And therefore, what you want to do is create a spirituality, a personality system that has, like I said, not overly caught up with the values and other kinds of things that the system creates, so that one can find a harmony and a sense of self-love even in the midst of these kinds of consequences, to create certain kinds of relationship with people and groups and families that can maintain one, because you don't have to be unhappy.
Right.
Okay? And you don't have to be in agony, even though you're not getting what you deserve, in a sense, in terms of your
child. You mentioned relievers of pain a bit earlier, and I think it relates to what this caller is speaking about. You talked about sex addiction, drugs. There's a whole series of quote-unquote pain relievers that have emerged within the context that this caller is speaking of.
And being also, you know, and of course, being very much into the advancement of black people and of African people, making that at the center of one's life, which gives you a very deep sense of purpose and devotion, which makes then often the other kinds of things that are laid on you, the consequences, have far less, I make them far less painful in that sense, because of this focus and because of this purpose, you see. And so I found in my own personal life, it's this kind of thing, this focus and this purposefulness of life, in the sense that what one is doing is supremely worthwhile and worth much more than what one is losing. That's very important.
WIB, you're on the air with Professor Amos Wilson. Go right ahead, please.
Hello, Gary. Professor Wilson.
Good afternoon.
Thank you. In the 60s, we saw and felt the presence of the Muslim community. They stood out in our community as positive. They stood out from the rest of the community.
Yes.
We need the large African community to come forward and take its, not temporary, but permanent position at the front. I think in the weekend, we should maybe put on a dashiki or some symbol of our African ancestry. I'm not saying to start going into the office immediately to create a scene with the dress codes, but we must move forward and let that African presence be felt. We have to set up our national congress. We will have to include our historians, lawyers, and other professionals who have left the plantation, because not all of them are right. So I say to all Africans, We have a message to send. We must beat our own drum to send this message, because for a long time others have been beating our drum, mm-hmm. but sending their message.
Definitely. Mm-hmm. And I agree with you fully. The Muslims under Elijah Muhammad in particular, I think, made a great example. Of course, Marcus Garvey as well, as to what we could do if we continued to expand that example and develop that example. Mm-hmm. And I think we should study it, the nation under Elijah Muhammad, particularly in the earlier phases, and look at it very closely and use it as a basis and foundation, and not permit the later events that a lot of people get carried away with, you know, and permit those things to blind us to the really good aspects of what was being developed there. I think it's a good model. There are other people, too, that we can look at as well in terms of developing a model for moving forward. I think also the change in the influence sometimes of Islam can also be instructive as well,
mm-hmm.
Because it speaks to the issue of the balance between quote-unquote religion and politics, and what happens when quote-unquote sometimes the religious aspect and the orthodox religious aspect becomes so predominant until often it knocks out other things.
We'll take a break for just a couple of minutes, and we're going to come back with our guest, Professor Amos Wilson. We are going to be with him until 4:30 this afternoon, so for those of you listening, we're going to do our best to get to every single one of your calls. So please stand by for as long as you can, and we'll come back and get back to you as soon as possible. 1190 WLIB, you're inside of the Great Black Expedition. We'll come back with more inside of the GBE, our topic, the psychology of self-hatred among global African people. More after this. You're on the air with Professor Amos Wilson.
Hello,
go right ahead, please.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
I just would like to make a statement. I noticed that white people tend to resent black people referring to themselves as brothers and sisters. Could you make a comment on that?
Definitely. It implies, of course, the brothers and sisters implies a certain unity of purpose and a certain group cohesiveness. And of course, the European system thrives on and is based on a lack of cohesion and a lack of unity of black people. So consequently, when that term is used often, fear and anxiety and resentment is provoked in many Europeans, who interpret it to mean that here are a group of people now who are united and who may then unite against our domination.
Mm. WIB, go right ahead, please. Your question, please.
Good afternoon, Brother Gary, and good afternoon, Brother Wilson.
Good afternoon.
First of all, I'd like to accuse both of you of being sane. And secondly, I was realizing that there's a lot of political polygamy that the brother didn't explain. I know he'll get to it because he's very thorough. Thanks. I have tried about 3 weeks of being a Negro, I found out I couldn't cut it. I had also tried other people's religions. So I had the good fortune of meeting the brother, and we talked a little bit. And I think that we had agreed that we should have an African religion coming to us out of voodoo. We could avoid all of the other stuff that the people has been laying on us, because as in voodoo, you do not have any white images. Mm-hmm. Would you comment on that, please?
Very, very important. And, of course, it's great to hear from me. At the risk of making a personal communication, I was listening last night, early this morning, to a beautiful poem being read. It was fantastic. I have to congratulate you on that. Of course, it's very important that we have religious images that represent us as people. You know, people often startle when I say the church will lead you to hell. And one of the illustrations I make about that is that often in the church is a direct breaking of a major rule. And that rule is, thou shalt not make unto me any graven images. And yet you walk in a church where you have a graven image, as we talked about earlier, of the white Jesus there, and a graven image representing a God, a godlike figure, which violates the very basic command of God itself. And in a sense, you can, that in itself symbolizes a breaking of a fundamental rule by the church itself. And of course, one of the reasons why you do not make graven images unto God is the fact that people identify with that image. I often say that people, in praising their gods, in ultimately in some way praise themselves and respect themselves. And in giving respect to their gods, they give respect to themselves. And I think an aspect of black self-respect will be, of course, a God that represents the black image.
1190 is WLIB. It's World Leadership in Broadcasting. The news is next at the top of the hour with Wayne Gilman. I'm Gary Bird. You're inside of the GBE. We'll move from the Great Black Expedition to Live Before 5, and we'll be taking you with us along with Professor Amos Wilson.
Okay. Short, so what we need is an organization that even if the individual goes, the organization remains. And I wonder if your guests have an idea of how such an organization could be set up.
Okay. I talk a great deal now about economics. I really try to get across this idea of the tremendous importance of economics to self-respect. We get a lot of conversation here at LIB and other places about the greatness of African people. And we hear about Egypt and Ghana and this one and that one. But too often, the conversation does not get into how and why these great civilizations came to being. In any great civilization, if you're going to talk about Egypt, you're going to find at the base of it a great economy. Mm-hmm. And if you're talking, and you often the impression is given that these people are great because they praise Ra or Ramses or someone else mm-hmm. was ahead of them, or we talk about the greatness of the pyramids without recognizing that the pyramids have to be paid for. You have to have an economy to build pyramids. You have to have an economy to build giant temples. And even though you pray to God, Ra, and so forth, it's men who build them in the long run. Even if you built them by slavery, you had to provision those slaves and the whole bit. So what you recognize in Egypt is a tremendous economy. What you will recognize in Ghana, again, is an economy, a control of gold and salt mine, a control of trade routes. Mali, the same thing. Have to gain an economic niche in this world and have control and engage in trade. And that means we're going to have to engage in basically all areas of trade. So we have to recognize that we're going to have to compete with numbers of ethnic groups. That even means ethnic groups within the so-called third world. As well, we have to face this possibility. We have to compete with the Japanese. We have to compete with people in Latin America and Central America. And I'm not talking about hostility, but this is a fact of life. This knowledge and how this is to be done has to be transmitted to black people and black children the ways that everyone else does it, through education, through teaching, through apprenticeship, and through organizing people so that their economic behavior can help to create an economic base. I think one of the ways we can do it, and there are other ways, is to recognize that the standard economic education that blacks receive in the universities is not sufficient to advance black economic interests. I say, isn't it ironic that you could have almost a direct relationship between the number of Asian businesses owned in Harlem and the number of blacks who receive degrees in business administration? So I'm sure in the last 10 years you can point to a larger number of black degrees in business administration and degrees in economics, and at the same time you can point to the larger influx of Asians and other groups owning the black community, which says one thing, that these degrees are not designed for you to have control of your economy, which implies another thing, that you have to educate your own people to do it, and you have to forget about being legitimized by white standard institutions build and construct your own legitimate institutions by actual education, by engaging in business and apprenticing young people into those businesses to actually build into them a business attitude. Get rid of this old idea of individual capitalism, which went out a long time ago, but many blacks are still hung up with this concept of individual capitalism, that they are going to build a business for themselves. You train a small number of individuals to begin with thoroughly. Then you get that small number of individuals to train others by what we call geometric growth. Within a short fraction of years, you could have trained economically a whole corps, a couple of thousand or more people, who would have been spread completely over the country, who would now have a connected network, one with the other, whose goal would be to move in their specific communities and positions of influence and so forth to lay an economic network and foundation for the creation of a black economy. And then from there, we'll do what everybody else does, build schools, institutions, and everything else for the continued development of our system and advancement of our system.
WLIB, you're on the air with Professor Amos Wilson.
Yeah, Gary, I greet you in the name of my African gods and my African ancestors, and I must say that you are truly two of the beer cups that Marcus Garvey said unleash.
Thank you.
You're living up to tradition. First, I just want to share with you, the sister had asked about Cain and Abel. There's a book she can get, Hebrew Myths, the Book of Genesis, by Robert Graves and Raphael Patai. And I will explain her question about Cain and Abel.
It's called what again?
Hebrew Myths, M-Y-T-H-S, the Book of Genesis by Robert Graves and Raphael Patai, P-A-T-A-I. Mm-hmm. And I'll explain a lot of the myths, the Hebrew myths in the Bible. Mm. Self-explanatory. She can pick it up for less than $6.
Who's the publisher?
McGraw-Hill.
Okay, thank
you. McGraw-Hill paperbacks.
Great.
Okay. Now,
thank you very much.
I'm an African who believes in race vindication. And you have a set of people who are going around still masquerading as leaders, misleading our people and telling us to be nonviolent. Your comment, Professor Wilson.
Mm-hmm. Certainly at times, violence is justifiable. In fact, I was talking to my classes earlier. There are times in struggling against oppression when violence, unfortunately, is called for and has to be used. Of course, I'm one who advocates only using violence when necessary, but recognizes the necessity of violence at times, mm-hmm. Which means, though, that violence, when it is perpetrated, must be perpetrated as a result of clear thinking and planning and organization, and not as reactionary, impulsive kinds of, as a result, reactionary, impulsive kind of behavior. And so one of the reasons why I kind of tend not to wholesalely talk about violence is because often you see many people who have not worked through who they are and what they are will engage in the kind of violence that brings more trouble than and creates more problems than it solves.
WLIB, you're on the air with Professor Amos Wilson, live before 5. Go right ahead, please.
Hello.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Professor Wilson.
Yes, ma'am.
I have enjoyed your remarks
Thank you very much.
I want to ask you, first of all, do you agree that when a very successful man or woman gets married, they generally seek the person who meets their physical ideals, satisfies their idea of physical perfection?
Certainly, that is almost always a part of making the choice of a mate.
Well, will you please comment on the fact that more and more very successful black men, and not so successful, but nevertheless, are marrying white women? And that when they do, as my observation, and I have occasion, I live in a complex where there are 7 such couples, all between successful black men and white women. They absolutely adore them and treat them like queens and sort of led around by the nose. They're very wimpish when married to white women.
Yeah.
More so than most black men who are married to black women are. And of course, I guess you could reverse that and say that when successful black women marry white men, they are also expressing certain attitudes, and I'd like to know what you think those attitudes are.
Okay, there are many. there are many related to this kind of behavior. Of course, a good deal of it is related to the fact that much of what we call education is the result of being made Eurocentric in our values and orientations. And therefore, we come to value things European as a result of being submitted, as a result of being brainwashed by the kind of education we often find necessary to succeed. And as a part of that, the European woman comes to represent to symbolize the ultimate in that kind of a system. She comes to represent what it means to marry a woman. She also comes to symbolize success. She comes to symbolize equality for black men, implying that his ability to marry her makes him equal to a white man because the white man marries this woman, and therefore he being able to do so now is equal. So it sort of caps off his success and symbolizes his success. Involved in that also is a form of self-hatred through which the individual commits what I call biological suicide, in that they often want to create children who do not look like them. If they have been convinced consciously and unconsciously that they are ugly, that the African features are not desirable, then often they will be motivated to create children who do not have features that look like themselves. And in a sense, it's a type of psychological beautification of the man himself, who transforms himself through his children by the fact now that they look different. Many black males equate the marrying of being with white women as indicative of their manhood. And the fact that the black manhood, masculinity, is often attacked in so many different ways. The getting of a white woman to love him implies that he has achieved manhood as such. Mm-hmm. Also, the education itself often alienates the black person from black culture and from the mainstream of black people, such that he finds that he can only be satisfied by moving, by marrying or relating to these other people. Plus, I've heard some black men say it's good, it's a good way of getting promoted and moved up in position, because it sort of signals to the other side that you are right, you know.
There's something that you said just a moment ago that I think in terms of maybe at the sake of going back and regressing for a moment, mm-hmm. you mentioned that there is in the adoption of a Eurocentric value system, mm-hmm. which then becomes the way to get the reward and the benefit of being in the society, as you were mm-hmm. talking about a bit earlier, mm-hmm. that in that process of adapting and actually accepting that we actually lose our own Afrocentricity, yes. and in some instances find that perhaps either man or woman, mm-hmm. that suddenly you can only relate to people of a Eurocentric value system.
You see, a part of becoming an educated servant is, of course, you have to become alienated to a good degree from your group. So moving up, it sort of goes together there, you see. Mm. If you're going to enjoy our wealth, make sure you don't transfer it back to the other people, and make sure you don't transfer the knowledge back. Ooh. And the whole bit. There's always that hidden contract for success for black people. And you will often hear black people, well, I didn't get this position because, you know, of my blackness. I got it because of my qualifications. And it's often the only black person you hear making that statement, which is an expression of the contract. Don't worry about me transforming now what I've gotten into black power and bringing other black people into it, white folk, you know. Therefore, I'm a safe bet on your part. And in a sense, it's almost an obligatory statement that we have to make in order to be accepted by that other group. Mm. But in the process of becoming accepted, we often then lose that emotional and other kind of attachment with our own.
WLIB, you're on the air with Professor Amos Wilson.
Yeah, Brother Bert.
Afternoon.
I've been trying to get it for so long. Professor Wilson.
Yes, sir.
I would like to know, how enthralled is the Stockholm Syndrome to the race of our people that create our problem?
is the Miss.
I'm sure you're aware of what the Stockholm Syndrome is.
I'm familiar. It has a certain familiarity, but could you explain it to me?
Well,
a little
the Stockholm Syndrome was some time ago where a certain number of people were held in a train, and when they came off the train, they were all in favor of the personal victimizer.
Oh, yes, 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 yes. I understand what you're saying now. When you're talking about often people who are made hostage, this is also a part of the piece today that we didn't get to, that instilling of self-hatred into a person. Often when a person is held hostage, there's a kind of thought that takes place. In the sense that let's look at it in terms of white and black. The fact that we are oppressed by these people.
We're their hostage.
Pardon me?
Are they hostage?
He's saying we're their hostage.
Yes, we are. Yes, we are. And often many individuals will read that as meaning then that they must have something really going for them. They must be good. They must be great, or else I won't be in this position. So, in that sense, even though one is held hostage, one seeks to identify with them. Also, don't forget that often when one is being held hostage, one is a captive audience. And there's a control of information and control of behavior like we talked about earlier. And these things, too, are used to condition the individual into a relationship often with the person who's holding them hostage. Often, too, if they engage in debate or because they're in the position they're in, they come to doubt the values and orientations that they had before. And often because they are alienated from the people who helped them to maintain the original values, the values begin to fall apart.
Mm-hmm.
And the individual then begins to replace them by the new kinds of values. Also in a hostage situation, in the situation that we find ourselves as black people, there is an implied demand there. And you can see it in the father-child relationship. The father says, you are being punished because you are not like me. You see, you don't think like me, you don't act like me, you don't do what I tell you to do, you don't look like me, and the whole bit. And so the child makes a logical conclusion that says, well, then I can escape being punished and hurt if I could be what? More like daddy, think like mm-hmm. them, you know, be like them and assume their behavior, I would be released from the pain. So consequently, the individual who is suffering as a result, often the way we've suffered under these people, we assume that if we can identify with them, if they cannot see any difference between ourselves and themselves, then we would no longer be victimized by them. So consequently, the oppressed individual is motivated by his pain often to identify and become totally one with the people who are the source of that pain.
That is amazing. We'll take a break at 1190 WLIB Radio in the Key of Life. We have a couple of minutes of announcements, and then we'll take a break for news headlines on the half hour. Professor Wilson, if you got a bit more time, we'll wrap up the week and the afternoon with some of the callers who've been holding on. Stand by, those of you listening, and for those of you who are right now sort of like in your cars or at work and who have basically stopped to digest some of this, I'm sure that your brain is doing what mine is. We'll come back right after this at WLIB Radio in the Key of Life.
Good evening, Sunday. You know, take away. Mm-hmm. And at Esplanade Garden, we had a wonderful black co-op. Mm-hmm. And what did they do? They took it so that the unions would not deliver. So we have tried, and that's a big development.
Mm-hmm.
But they said, no, no, no.
Mm-hmm.
So this is the way they handle it.
Yes.
Good.
We have to realize that as I've often mentioned to others, that when we really struggle for self-control and independence, I mean, you're really in a war, and you're going to have some casualties, and people are going to throw some body blows at you, and we have to be prepared to accept the consequences and try to deal with those consequences. But getting to know who we are and getting over the kinds of conflicts that have been created in us through this process of self-hatred will permit us to develop a creativity that will often help us to get around the roadblocks that these people are going to try to throw in our way as we move toward independence and power.
WLIB, good afternoon. You're on the air with Professor Amos Wilson.
Peace, Gary. Brother Wayne, how you doing?
Wayne, good afternoon,
peace, brother.
Brother
Wayne.
All right.
Okay.
Yes.
Brother is dealing, Gary.
Indeed.
He's dealing. Brother Amos, if you would be so kind as to share with us, I have a question about dealing with those brothers and sisters within the community who are very committed to their blackness and their African heritage. But when they're approached about getting into an economic mindset,
yes,
and developing an economic prosperity within the community,
mm-hmm,
which can support the community, they're turned off. They don't,
yes,
want to deal with it.
Mm-hmm.
Could you speak on that?
Very definitely, because this is something I'm very much concerned with, and as a way of putting it, a plug, I wish the public would come by and see us over there at Harlem Graphic Arts, because we are trying to deal with this kind of situation. And one of the things we're trying to demonstrate over there at Harlem Graphic Arts is that black nationalism has a definite economic outcome, and that is just not a philosophy. Many people have been led to think, to see black nationalism as an attitude. You know, so you get a lot of people saying, "Oh, you know, I don't sleep with white women. I don't do so." As if that is the end and be all of what black nationalism is about. Ultimately, black nationalism has to justify itself in a way that says, by believing and supporting the nationalist program, you increase wealth, you increase power. It is not a vote for poverty. It is not a vote for deprivation.
Right.
And we have to make that very, very clear. Many of our people have been traumatized by the economic system. We see ourselves as having been taken into slavery and taken advantage of because of quote-unquote capitalism and economic greed. And consequently, we have a phobia often about money and where money and wealth fits within the African community. And consequently, many people will not face up to it rationally and squarely, but will have what almost a knee-jerk reaction to the issue of money and wealth because of its association with their exploitation and misuse and abuse. We are going to have to confront the issue of where money fits and where wealth fits within black growth and development and advancement, and deal with the anxiety that brings about. Many of us are afraid that wealth and so forth will lead us off the African path, as if Africa somehow did not create wealth and was based on wealth. The other thing I look at is you have what I call a pseudo-nationalism out there. It's a nationalism that is reactive. Are people who have really not gotten over their self-hatred, but who try to deal with their self-hatred by an over-glorification of African things and an obsession, a compulsive, obsessive relationship to African history, assume and therefore try to make up for their feeling of inferiority by narcissistically getting involved deeply in history and singing it out, and therefore being so narcissistically obsessed by the history, they fail to see the other vital things that are necessary for advancing us as a people.
They don't use the history, in other words.
No, they don't use the history, and the history is limited. See, it's what I said earlier, where people will study Egyptian history, but they will not study Egyptian economics. And they will not look at the relationship between the economic system and the culture. And they are trying to compensate for their personality defect by glorifying their African heritage, which should be done, but that is not going to solve the problem. And often then they become obsessed by it. The other thing, often people who join black nationalist organizations, these pseudo-nationalists, still have not gained their self-confidence. Many of them have joined in order to be accepted by whites, and that's a strange kind of thing, you know. In the sense that you have some people writing African history who have written that history not because they love Africans so much or themselves so much, but they have praised Egypt and praised this and praised that in the hope that if whites one day would recognize the greatness of these things and ultimately recognize the greatness of black people, then whites would accept them and love them as equals, you see. So there's still the motivation of seeking approval behind often this nationalism. Often also behind nationalism, which appears on the surface to be a hatred or a hostility toward whites, actually covers over a love for these people. But it's the kind of thing that says, well, since you won't accept me, I got mad and I'm going to, you know, talk about you. I'm going to create this attitude such that, in a sense, I'm going to frighten you into loving me, and I'm going to show you that it's our right to love me. One other thing. We have to be cautious of peoples whose leadership is based upon the poverty of black people and upon the misery of black people. Often there is an unconscious drive and motive to maintain that misery as a foundation for their own status and a foundation for their own leadership. So often you see individuals speaking in the name of the advancement of black people and for the development of black people, but when you actually watch their behavior, almost any move you make toward advancing and developing black people is negated by them, often in the name of some African system or some African economic approach that says, well, Africans don't engage in business, or Africans don't get into capitalist development or this kind of business. So they are paralyzed by their ambivalence toward, if I move the people up, then where will I fit in a new system? Also, there's a lack of self-confidence that says, as long as we're in the condition we're in, I can be leader and I don't have to deal with the outside world. So often you have these people, while spouting the African nationalist code, are still hiding and escaping from the direct confrontation that's going to be necessary to move us forward as people.
Amazing. Wayne, thank you for the call. WIB, you're on there with Professor Amos Wilson. Go right ahead, please.
Good afternoon, Gary, and good afternoon to Professor Amos.
Good afternoon.
Thank you.
I'd like the professor to comment on certain famous people who alter their natural African features, people like Michael Jackson, Jackson, Latoya Jackson, and Rebe Jackson.
Well, it's essentially what we've indicated this afternoon of people who essentially people who are dealing with the concept of self-hatred by trying to transform their physical features to more resemble the people in power, and hoping then that through this transformation they will be accepted and not identified directly with a group that has negative connotations. To a pretty much good extent, this is what that involves. Mm-hmm. When you attack people's hair, when you attack their color and things like this, mm-hmm. they often then will seek to change their hair and change colors, you, as the Garvey piece indicated,
right.
to try to more closely resemble. If the enemy cannot recognize you as different, then he has no basis for making you a victim, because discrimination implies reacting to a person on the basis of difference.
You're indicating
so you reduce the difference in order to reduce the suffering.
You're indicating then that that's somewhat the apex of self-hatred, at that point that you physically, literally transform.
Very, very much so.
Mm-hmm. WIB, good afternoon. You're on there with Professor Amos Wilson.
Yes, Professor and Gary.
Yes.
Professor, the problem that I face as a black person, and I think all black people face, seems to me stem from the fact that our forefathers were slaves.
Mm-hmm.
And as I see it, not wanting to sound pessimistic, mm-hmm. but the evils of slavery have followed us for 500 years,
yes.
and it seems as if it's going to continue to follow us.
Yes.
So I like to back up a little and say, let's go back now to 1441.
Mm-hmm.
Here we are in Africa. We have gold, we have elephant tusks, which yes. are valuable up to today.
Mm-hmm.
We know then that the University of Timbuktu was on par with Oxford and Cambridge University.
Right.
So, I mean, it's no problem, we had education.
Yes.
Along come the Portuguese guys to make a trade.
Mm-hmm.
He gets gold. He gets elephant tusk. He gets 10 human beings as slaves.
Mm-hmm.
What happened in that trade? There was a breakdown there, because I don't think the African got anything to compare what he gave up.
Mm-hmm. You, the question you ask is a very, very vital one, and I wish it would certainly take more time we have today to deal with that issue. I think in dealing with our so-called problems and self-hatred, we are really going to have to confront the issue of our own participation in part of in our enslavement as such, and what part did we pay, and I think Chancellor Williams begins to deal with that to a good extent. Mm-hmm. What kind of psyche did we have as a people that permitted often us to trade each other in slavery? Of course, we'd have to speculate that a slave system already existed to a degree. The Arab slave trading that existed there that also had created a slave system of exchange. Also, the idea that I mentioned very early in the program of where desires have been provoked through for items, for materials and things that the Europeans had and created. And, of course, once those desires were provoked, the demands for slaves were made in exchange for those items, or where divisions existed between certain African groups, perhaps as a result of, as Williams talked about, as they moved further down into the continent and they break up into various groups and linguistic groups and so-called tribal groups, and these tribal differences are being exploited by Europeans to buy slaves, and where one group is pitted against another group in terms of, let us say, weapons trade. I'll give you weapons to move you so that you can have economic and political power, but that would, if you only get this weapon at the behest of selling me some other person's group, mm-hmm. plus fitting maybe into a tradition where people captured in war were permitted to perhaps be traded. You have all of these kinds of things that existed, I think, and of course Dr. Benz and other people could be much more clear about this than I am, that perhaps laid a groundwork for a lot of the activities that we engaged in. A very interesting book in that regard, too, if you can find it, is the book by Chinwezu called The West and the Rest of Us. And he deals very directly with that issue of African slave traders, Africans themselves. And to a good extent, he tries to show the relationship between that group and current neocolonial leadership, and I can see even a relationship between that group and current leadership even within the African-American community that often seeks to sell its people out for trinkets like stereos mm-hmm. and a car house on the corner and things like that that involves selling other people out. Of course, you do that when you produce a certain amount of alienation among people such that they can do this kind of selling because they have been given a rationale through brainwashing and miseducation that this can be done without guilt.
Let's get to a couple more telephone yes. calls, and we will have completed, actually, those who are at least on hold for most of the afternoon. WLIB, go right ahead, please. You're on the air with Professor Amos Wilson. Hello.
Oh, hello, Gary.
Yes, good
yes,
afternoon.
I was holding so long, I kind of forgot I was...
I know, we've been trying to get to you. Good afternoon. What's the question?
Yeah, relevant to the issue we're talking about today about self-hatred. This is, my name is Zakiya Newman from New Mind Productions.
Yes.
And Professor Wilson is probably familiar with Dr. Akbar's work on chains and images of psychological slavery.
Very much. But also,
mm-hmm. I wanted to mention another book entitled An African American Genesis,
mm-hmm.
which I thought was very relative to something that was mentioned earlier about us recreating ourselves as mm-hmm. a new people. And this book is by Imam Warsdeen Muhammad, who of course has a lot of insight into, you know, what the Nation of Islam was about
mm-hmm.
and, you know, our needs as a people. So I wanted to mention that this book is not available right now, but it will be very soon.
I appreciate that mention.
An African American Genesis.
Great. Mm-hmm. You know, this is actually African American Genesis is perhaps the struggle that we're talking about. There is mm-hmm. a kind of from the beginning mm-hmm. going through to now that when we look at maybe the crime of not getting our history in terms of the educational system,
yeah.
that in itself is one crime.
Mm-hmm.
But the perspective
perspective that we should actually be gaining from the study of that history is almost equally as important as getting that history itself.
I said earlier, Gary, and let me just make... You see, the rediscovery of African culture, let me just put it this way quickly, because since we don't have much time, I had a note here. Because he must have been robbed of his common sense. And we recognize that, I mentioned earlier, we have to be dumb to exist in this situation, you see.
Crazy, for sure.
Yes, because he must have to have been robbed of his common sense, his intellectual capacities, his culture, creativity, and sense of reality has to have been taught to be dumb. The black man will experience a consciousness, an intellectual expansion, and a clarity of vision, and spiritual harmony, and increase in intelligence when he summons the courage to regain and reclaim his alienated self and culture. We must recognize, you see, when you talk about people robbing you of history, they're not only robbing you of history, of self-knowledge, they are robbing you of intelligence. They are robbing you of a clarity of vision. They are also robbing you of intellectual character and wisdom, because the control of information upon which we build intellect and wisdom and vision and so forth is restricted, you see. We are in a very peculiar situation of where people who create us because they have control of things, and yet they become our sole authorities for what reality is, you see. And therefore we are thrown back up on them as the authority for telling us who and what we are. And consequently, we can never get out of the box we're in. This is why in the long run, it is the greatest liars in the world who also are the greatest validators of truth. And so you have a situation here of where all we have been boxed in mentally, psychologically, and in every other way.
What can I say, brother?
It's been a pleasure indeed.
What an afternoon. This is only one though of many I hope that we will have.
I hope we'll be able to pursue, though, the behavior that comes out of this. And I want to get to the fact that most of us as black do not experience ourselves as hating ourselves. We experience self-hatred as a self-love, and I want to deal with that, and I want to talk about how our self-hatred comes out in the form of love and deal with the whole concept of criminality, drug behavior, sex behavior, having babies, and finally to move into a real solid program for getting us out of this situation.
Okay, we'll call this phase one then.
Yes,
point one on the pyramid. All right, good enough. Thank you, brother.